From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his book, the historian Mark Essig explores the 10,000-year history of the domestic pig, which he describes as a tale of love and loathing. We've cast them out, pigs, seen them as filthy and disgusting, yet who doesn't love bacon and pork belly? You see what I mean? The part of the book that might surprise you is how human history has converged with pig history. Our evolutionary paths went in similar directions. We have the same kind of teeth as pigs, the same kind of skin and stomachs. Essig says we look back at the pig and see quite a bit of ourselves, and then, more often than not, we eat him. That's the real problem with the story of the pig. Our relationship is complicated. We'll talk about it with Mark Essig after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We have a complicated history with pigs. As the historian Mark Essig found out, pigs are smart. In his new book, he explains they can be curious, clever, and playful, clearly the most fascinating creatures in the barnyard. But he also says they're fractious and surly and independent-minded, and they're also delicious. Essig describes them as a prodigious producer of meat, the precious mother source of bacon, but for thousands of years, cultures refused to eat pork. We saw them as filthy and indolent. Essig says the problem with the pig is particularly relevant today because it raises questions about the environment, about public health, about animal welfare. In his book, he explores the 10,000-year history of the domestic pig to make sense of the life of the pig today. The full title of the book, Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. Mark Essig's writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle. He's joining us today from a studio in his hometown in St. Louis, Missouri. And Mark Essig, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be here.
So I want to begin with hog drives, which I had no idea about. And they're kind of like cattle drives in some ways. But a hog drive, I mean, that doesn't even sound right. But I guess in some ways that was sort of your way into this story.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I had the same reaction about 8 years ago. My wife and I and our son, we were living in Los Angeles, and we moved. I took a job in Asheville, North Carolina, which is a town in the middle of the Blue Ridge Mountains. And right in the middle of town, there are statues of hogs. And I'm a historian by training, and so I started to read a little local history to find out why those statues were there. And what I discovered was that in the years, especially before the Civil War, these tremendous herds of hogs, tens of thousands, as many as 100 or 150,000 some years, were driven on the hoof through the center of town. And so I started following the path of those hogs. And what I discovered was that up north of Asheville in Eastern Tennessee, it was a little mini corn belt. They raised a lot of corn. They raised a lot of pigs, but there was no market for them there. But down on the other side of the Blue Ridge Mountains in South Carolina and Georgia, they raised a lot of cotton. They owned a lot of slaves, and they didn't have enough food to feed them. So you had a supply of hogs on one side of the mountains and a demand for them on the other, and there were no navigable rivers or railroads to get them from one place to the other. So they had to walk. So you'd have a drover who would lead the hogs on horseback most often, and then drivers following behind, usually one per 100 pigs, and they would use whips and sometimes dogs to keep the hogs in line. It was just so delightful to me to – we always grow up hearing the stories of the of cattle drives. They're so self-serious with the stern cowboy sitting around the campfires. And hog drives, it seemed – almost comical, like who knew that a hog could walk 100 miles or that it would go in the direction that you wanted it to go. Right. And so I started following those paths, and the pig took me to all sorts of interesting places.
Yeah. So you learn about these hog drives, and then you, one of the things that's interesting is you're working on this. You volunteered to be on this pig crew of a farm run by the college where you were working. And this is where you get a real, I guess it would be fair to say, kind of a more intimate or anyway personal view of pigs. And you describe them, as I mentioned in the introduction, you know, curious and surly and skittish, but also playful. At what point in that sort of experience on the – and I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. What were you noticing about pigs, and how is it that that made you think – I really want to write about this. I really want to explore the history of pigs.
I'd started to read more about pigs, and I thought that, you know, there's only so much you can learn by sitting in a library and reading. And so I had been teaching journalism at a little school called Warren Wilson College outside of Asheville, North Carolina. And it used to be the Asheville Farm School, and they still have a working farm there with sheep and cattle and hogs and chickens. And I started volunteering with the pigs. These are students who operate the farm, and I worked with the students as they manage the pig farm. And they have boars, and they mate them with the sows there. The sows farrow, so I helped out with the farrowing. I helped out with clipping the needle teeth of pigs, which they still do there. The young male pigs are castrated, so I helped out with that process as well. And I just most routinely, I mucked out the stalls, I fed the pigs, and particularly the sows, I discovered, are very powerful and surly creatures. When you walk out into a pasture with a 5-gallon bucket full of a corn, soy, barley blend to feed these sows, they want to get that food first. And so you had to be careful. You had to keep an eye on them, make sure you didn't get knocked over from behind. And then when you had to tend the feeders, of the younger pigs. They were just such curious and delightful creatures. You'd walk in and they would scatter fearfully away from you. And then in a few minutes, they'd come wandering back up and they'd start prodding at your rubber boots with their snouts. And you'd kick a little bit and they'd run away and then they'd come right back. And then they'd go leaping through the fields like young dogs or like young deer or some cross between them. And you could just tell that there was more going on behind those curious eyes. When you look at a cow or a sheep, they can be beautiful creatures, but they look a little dull. They don't look that interested in what's going on. And the pig just seemed fully engaged with the world, and it made me want to get more fully engaged with pigs.
It's interesting that George Orwell makes the pigs the cleverest, really the most diabolical of the characters in his book. Does that say something about sort of their reputation? Did he know they were this clever, this smart?
Yeah, the perception that pigs are smart, it goes pretty far back. Even in some ancient Roman writers, they notice certain stories of pigs. For instance, there's a story in, I believe it's Pliny the Elder, tells a story of pigs who were on board a ship and it started listing over to one side and threatening to capsize. And the pigs all rushed to the other side to balance out the cargo again, and the ship sailed cleanly on. And whether you believe that or not is one thing, but there was clearly the perception that these were extremely smart creatures. And you can find that going straight through, not only that they're smarter than other barnyard creatures, but that you have to keep an eye on them because unlike they're not placid creatures. They fight with each other. They'll be aggressive towards people. So along with intelligence, when you have an intelligent creature, that means that they're often not willing to do what you tell them to do. And that's what that, I think, is what Orwell was getting at.
Yeah, I love this piece of writing in the book. It's in the preface early on. You write that compared to cows and sheep, pigs are arrogant bastards.
Yeah, that's I put that in to sort of play off the subtitle because we call it the humble pig.
Yeah.
And humble hasn't that's borrowed from Charlotte's Web, where humble means low to the ground, yeah. The same root as hummus for soil. And they are low to the ground and they are considered low class. But on the other hand, they are not at all humble when they look back at people and decide how they're going to react to what the people want them to do.
Yeah. There's, of course, a brutal reality at the heart of all of this in terms of our relationship with pigs, and it's that their true value has never been about companionship or how clever they are, but it's, as you put it in the book, their value is as food, and they're unique in that way, which makes this really a conflicted story. I guess that's part of what really made made this interesting for you.
It's really the story. I mentioned Charlotte's Web, and it's what drives that story. It's what drives the movie Babe and the book The Sheep Pig, upon which the movie Babe was based, which is that the pig learns that these other creatures in the barnyard are going to have a longer life than him. Yeah. The goose is going to lay eggs. The sheep is going to give wool. The cow is going to give milk. But there's only one job for the pig, and that's to die and give meat. So in those children's stories, which I'd argue are good adult stories too, yeah. That's the central drama. How are you going to save the pig from the butcher block? But of course, for most pigs, that doesn't happen. And the reason you could consider pigs to be extremely evolutionarily successful in that they have spread all over the world and they live with us in tremendous numbers. But the downside of that, as far as pigs are concerned, is that they live a fairly short period of time before they end up on our dinner plates.
Yeah. That's one theme in the book, and we'll get back to that. There's another one here, and this one surprised me. And we'll get into the details shortly, but you write about just how connected human beings are to pigs, connected in our evolutionary development, and also that, you know, pigs have been right there with us as we developed and expanded as a species.
Yeah, they were there. You could say that we're similar in our lack of evolutionary development almost. We're both generalists. We have a full complement of mammalian teeth. The more specialized animal lost the generalized teeth and only kept the ones they needed. But pigs and people, we kept simple teeth, simple guts, and that's allowed us to live in many different circumstances all over the world. And that's also what made the pigs so useful to humans, regardless of where they lived. They could share our food before they became our food as well.
The pig evolved differently from other creatures like cows and sheep and deer. They don't need to devote the same kind of energy to digestion, which freed them up to grow a more sophisticated brain, which is kind of our story too, humans.
Yeah, this is known as the expensive tissue hypothesis, and the gut demands a great deal of energy. And when you look at the digestive system of a ruminant like a cow, they have multiple stomachs, and there's a lot of grinding and churning going on in there as you break apart this very hard to digest material, cellulose, into carbohydrates and sugars that the cow can eat. But because pigs, like people, eat calorie-dense materials like fruits, nuts, meats, roots, grains, that means they don't need to devote their energy to their gut, and some of that energy can be redirected towards the brain. And that's one of the reasons that a pig has a more flexible intelligence than these other creatures. You could think of it this way, that a pig has to make decisions about what to eat, whereas a cow or a sheep, it spots something green, it can pretty much start chewing it. Whereas a pig, it needs to decide which of these options before it can choose to eat.
I want to ask you about the domestication part of the story, which is really interesting. Talk about the discovery of this tiny ancient village in Turkey. Halan Semi, is that how it's pronounced?
To be honest, I think your guess is as good as
mine.
Okay,
good. Let's go with that, which I think the story sort of tells us a lot about the relationship between early humans and pigs. Talk about this discovery of this village.
Yeah, I think when you talk about the process of first domestication, it's useful to compare what happened with pigs to what happened with goats and cows. And pigs are descended from the Eurasian wild boar, and this is an animal that lived all across the continent of Eurasia, from Southeast Asia all the way up to Northern Europe. And they are thought to have been domesticated into domestic pigs on four or five or six different occasions independently. The time we know most about happened in the ancient Near East about 10,000 years ago. And this was the same time that agriculture was developed, all forms of it. When when barley and rye and wheat, when early hunter-gatherers decided that they didn't need to harvest these crops in the wild, that they could save the seeds and plant them in the ground and have a more reliable source of food. And when they realized that they didn't just have to hunt animals, that they could keep these animals around all the time and kill them as needed. And when archaeologists study this process, and they do this by looking at ancient bone heaps, garbage heaps of animal bones going back tens of thousands of years, and they look at the demographic profiles of these bones, what's the sex of these animals, how old were they when they were killed. And so when they look at goats, what they think happened was that over a period of thousands of years, the hunter-gatherers in the wild followed these wild goats through the hills. And gradually, in the early years, they killed more or less indiscriminately. But then in the later years, they find that they were killing mostly young male goats. And what this suggests is what we would call a sustainable harvest strategy. You don't need many males to continue the herd. So you kill most of the males, preserve a few, and preserve all the females because those, of course, are the ones that are going to give birth to more kids and continue the herd. So it's thought that gradually this process of hunting and then selective hunting gradually turned into herding and then domestication. But that process doesn't work with pigs because pigs don't live in open country. The Eurasian wild boar at the time would have been living in forests, in small groups. You can't follow and observe them and kill them selectively. So there's no way that hunting them could have turned into herding them and domesticating them. So it's thought that what happened is that 10,000 years ago, this was about the first time that people settled into permanent villages. And when people gather together, one of the things that they're best at is producing garbage. Right. And so they would have had scraps of hunted animals laying around, burnt grains, spoiled nuts. And the pigs, it's thought, lurked into town. And slunk into town, and they would eat this garbage. And this was, as we mentioned earlier, pigs and people can eat the same thing. So the cast-offs from human society were a perfect food source for pigs. Now, certain pigs were better at this than others. Yeah. They had to be bold enough that they were not afraid to go among people, right, you know, who had spears and bows and arrows that might kill them. But they also couldn't be so bold that they posed a threat to people and would therefore be killed. So they had to be – it favored a population of these wild boar with certain skills. And gradually that population separated off from wild boar and not through artificial selection but through a true evolutionary process of natural selections. The line of – wild boar that were best at this gradually evolved into what we know as domestic pigs.
Yeah.
So you could say that while goats were domesticated by people, pigs domesticated themselves.
Yeah. It makes sense if you think about really how remarkable they are as creatures. Let's talk about you write about foods like the societies that food is arranged in these hierarchies, and pork always ends up at the bottom of this hierarchy. And I want to kind of explore, as you do in the book, the root of this anxiety over pigs. And a lot of it is because of their appetites, as you mentioned, and they eat really disgusting stuff. Even though their diet is like ours, pigs will eat feces, and they will eat – I guess a pig will eat a human. I mean, you tell this really creepy, scary story from not so long ago, 2012. An Oregon farmer was – I guess he was eaten by his pig or pigs.
Yeah, that's what they think happened. This farmer went out to feed his sows, didn't come back, so his family went out to check on him, and they found his eyeglasses and a few fragments of bones, and that was it. And apparently the sows had eaten all of the rest of him, and nobody knows quite what happened there. But there's a long history of pigs eating people. And as I say in the book there, of all the animals we commonly eat, they're the only one that will happily return the favor.
Right, right. But this is the heart of our anxiety about pigs, I guess, is because they will eat, again, disgusting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it helps to go back to that to that village in the ancient Near East 10,000 years ago. And when you think about what a tremendous resource the pig was, just the cleaning up of the garbage would have been tremendously useful. They couldn't have known that it was a good way to fight disease to get rid of this, because they wouldn't have known about this public health measure, but they certainly would have been happy to get rid of the stink. So here's this creature that just wanders in from the wild, volunteers to be the town garbage man, and then as a bonus, you can kill it, and it gives you delicious meat and fat. And for the first 5,000 years or so of pig domestication, it seems that people were delighted. I mean, think about that alchemical transformation, garbage into food.
Right.
Who wouldn't enjoy and embrace that? But by about 3,000 years ago, the first civilizations had developed in Mesopotamia and a little bit later in Egypt. And when you have civilization, one of the things that comes automatically along with that is a social hierarchy.
Right.
And very early, you see evidence that part of the social hierarchy is a differentiation of what people eat. And the most elite food from these early dates was clearly lambs and kids, baby goats. And at the bottom of this hierarchy was pigs. And the reasons for that are complex, but the most basic reason simply seems to be these pigs ate filth. They would
right.
eat, as you said, feces on the streets, dead animals. In ancient texts, you read curses like, "May swine drag your corpse through the streets." It was considered the worst thing possible to end your life by having your body eaten by a pig. And so when we think there's almost a universal taboo against eating feces, eating corpses, cannibalism, and eating pig, to many people started to seem like those you almost a transitive property of of poison and contagion that way. If you eat things that eat these filthy things, then you will become filthy yourself. So very quickly, the pig became a pariah animal to be eaten only by people who could not find anything else to eat.
We're with Mark Essig, historian, talking about his book, Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. And we'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Have you seen the little piggies crawling in the dirt? And for all the little piggies, life is getting worse.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about pigs and our conflicted relationship with them. We're learning more and more about pigs, about how smart they are, how clever and personable, which, of course, is running up against the other thing we know about pigs. It's that they're delicious. Mark Essig's book is called Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. And he's joining us today to talk about it. So I guess it makes sense that Jews banned pork. I mean, it became codified in scripture, you write about. But do we know for sure why Jews first banned pork? You say there are a lot of theories on the subject.
Yeah, the one thing that we know for sure is that it didn't have anything to do with trichinosis. It's an interesting story in itself, in that once we isolated the cause of this disease, trichinosis, as being a parasitic worm back in the late 19th century, people began to think that, oh, it was just a public health measure. The Jews were very wise on this, and they knew that eating pork could lead to this horrible disease. But it turns out that, popular as that theory is, it's almost certainly not true, because there's no proof that the disease existed in the ancient Near East. And there's a very long incubation period between exposure and coming down with the symptoms, so it would have been hard for them to make the connection between the two. So to answer the questions, you need to dig deeply into the scriptures of these various religions. But I think what was most helpful to me was to discover that this attitude was not unique to the ancient Israelites. By the time the Jews got around to codifying their pork prohibition in the book of Leviticus, which it's uncertain what was probably written down about 700 or 800 BC, almost no one in the Near East of the priestly classes, the upper classes, was eating pork. So
right.
when they banned it, they would have surprised almost no one.
Yeah.
And there are a number of interesting theories. There's the most simple one I mentioned, which is simply that pigs were filthy because they ate filthy things. There's another fascinating theory that looks at the fact that pigs can be raised as a local food resource. It's something that people could do on their own around their house, eating garbage, eating waste, and it therefore provided what we would call food security, a source of food outside of official state control, and that the central authorities wanted absolute control, wanted people to be dependent on them to eat. So one of the reasons to ban pork may have been to deprive them of this means of independence. So that's another theory that I find fascinating, although still not quite proven.
Right.
To me, the most compelling reason is simply that these were religions that were very concerned with purity. And when it comes to purity, the pig leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm not sure if this is just sort of a diversion here, but you did point out the story of Adam and Eve in the Bible, that while they were in the garden, of course, they were vegetarians. And it wasn't until they were expelled from the garden that they began to eat flesh. As you put it, meat is the food of the fallen. Would you just say something about that? I find that kind of an interesting way of thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long tradition. I mean, you'll find it in the rhetoric of vegans today, that there's somehow something that eating plants is pure, eating flesh is impure. Mm. And even in the Bible, when after the flood is when people started eating meat. But even then, there were very strict rules. You could not eat meat that had not been properly drained of its blood, because the spirit of the creature was in the blood, and you couldn't eat the spirit along with the flesh. And so people were no longer vegetarians, but they could only eat vegetarians, which means you can eat a sheep or a cow, because those creatures eat only pure plant matter, but you couldn't eat a pig because they were so widely known to eat carrion in the streets and other impure things.
What about the Romans? They embraced pork. I mean, they ate a lot of animals, of course, but you say their favorite was the pig.
Yeah, it must have. You can see the shock reflected across thousands of years when you read Roman writers when they first start writing about Jews, just how deeply puzzled they were that Jews would deny themselves this source of food, because Romans loved pork more than anybody, I think, before or since. There's one surviving book of recipes from ancient Rome, and there's a handful of recipes for beef. There's about a dozen for lamb, and there are just dozens and dozens for pork, sausages, and there are 17 recipes for suckling pig alone, and then bizarre things like roast udder of lactating sow, like to have the milk of the sow somehow mixed up with the meat and then roasted. They sacrificed pigs to the gods at the drop of a hat. Every time you got married or signed a treaty, you would kill a piglet to mark the occasion. And so there was this very sharp contrast. You know, they're just around the corner from each other in the Mediterranean, these
right.
two peoples. But there are religious differences. The Roman religions were not quite so purity-minded as the Near Eastern religions. But I think it also had a lot to do with the way pigs lived. In the Near East, it was a desert country, and the only good habitat for pigs was on city streets eating garbage. The Italian peninsula, by contrast, you had oak forests where pigs could wander around and eat acorns. Rome was also a very wealthy empire that could command all of the resources of the Mediterranean. They imported grains from Egypt and elsewhere, and they fed some of that very expensive imported grain to their pigs. Mm. So rather than living on filth, the pigs ate very clean things. They tasted delicious, and they ended up at the very center of Roman culture.
You say the Romans they created the first farming manuals for pigs in some ways. Did they sort of set the stage for raising pigs exclusively for meat?
They did. These manuals, I think it's probable that the Greeks were very good at these practices as well. It's just that they didn't leave us the detailed manuals about it. There's very loving descriptions of the swineherd Emmaus in the Odyssey. But the Romans left us very detailed rules about pigsties and how to build them and what to feed pigs, breeding characteristics, as well as details about curing. You could follow an ancient Roman advice on how to cure a ham and end up with a pretty good piece of meat.
Let's talk a little bit about you write about pigs and their story in Europe, also in colonial America. Would you say something about that? How did pigs ended up here? I guess you mentioned in the New World. I guess the second voyage of Columbus, is that right?
That's right. The first one was more exploratory. The second one, when he brought back some gold trinkets and some other things, he convinced the rulers of Spain to fund him a little bit better, and he went back with just about everything you might need to recreate a European diet in the New World. Lots of different plants, grains, fruits, and the full complement of domesticated animals from Europe. And almost all of them struggled. He was planting these colonies in Jamaica, what's now the Dominican Republic, and Haiti, and most of those plants and animals weren't suited to that climate. The pig, however, was successful right from the start. As soon as those sharp little hooves landed in the jungle mud, they found plenty to eat, everything from fruit to ground nesting birds to amphibians. And within 10 or 20 years, there were almost complaints about the way that pigs were taking over the country, that they were swarming like vermin upon the earth. You might see that as a complaint, but it actually turned out to be, at least as far as the Spanish were concerned, a good thing, because when Cortes and the Pizarros and other conquistadors set off to conquer the mainland, to conquer the few Indians who hadn't already been killed by European diseases, they took pigs with them. You would have soldiers at the front on horseback. You would have dogs. They had war dogs with them. But then trailing behind, you would have a swine herd, with a herd of swine that served as a mobile food supply. And so the pigs were really central to the Spanish colonization of Central and South America. And the exact same thing was true in North America, although those colonists didn't rely so much on armies. They brought pigs along. They turned their pigs loose in the woods. The pigs thrived. They bred like crazy. So the colonists in Virginia, New England, the Chesapeake Bay area could concern themselves with other matters and know that the pigs were doing their business in the woods and would be available as a supply of meat come fall and winter.
Mark Essig is with us. His book is Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. We'll take another quick break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Mark Essig. We're talking about his book, Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. So 1906, Upton Sinclair publishes the groundbreaking book, The Jungle, which I wanted you to talk about, if you would, because I guess it really lays bare the meat industry. And as you say in the book, it was especially bad news for pork.
What Sinclair set out to do in The Jungle was actually to start a socialist revolution. His primary concern was the working conditions of slaughterhouse laborers in Chicago. And those conditions were certainly horrendous. But what people focused on when they read his book, when it was first serialized in a magazine and then came out collected as a book, was these appalling descriptions of the way that sausage gets made, that rotten meat that had been rejected by European inspectors would get shipped back to Chicago, and it would get mixed up with fresh meat and chemicals, and there might be some dead rats and the poisoned bread that those rats had been eating, and it would all be sort of ground up into the hopper and, as Sinclair put it, sent out to the nation's breakfast. So it turned out Americans, they were more than happy to ignore the conditions of the workers, but when they looked at the sausage on their plates, they wanted a bit more reassurance that they were eating something that was healthy.
It's interesting. I just wanted to mention, you talk about how the consumption of meat, then it really plummets. And I guess I hadn't really thought of this, but you mentioned like cornflakes and other options for like breakfast. That's when that takes hold.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the one hand, you have appalling descriptions about what might be in meat. On the other hand, you have larger social forces at work. People were doing less manual labor. They were doing more office labor. They didn't need to eat such heavy foods. You throw in a depression and a couple of world wars that put certain strains on the meat supply. And you have a lot of forces working against the consumption of red meat. And the causes were complex, but the meat industry seemed to focus largely on the jungle and blame it all on Upton Sinclair.
Right. 1953, Americans were eating more beef than pork. So beef had rebounded. Pork really continued to struggle. And it goes through this process of reinvention that you write about. And that's sort of where we get to eventually, that campaign that a lot of us still are familiar with, pork, the other white meat. Talk about this part of the story.
Well, as beef, as you say, rebounded, it had always been the meat of special occasions, the most prestigious meat, whereas pork had been the meat of country people and poor people, not insignificantly people without refrigerators, because pork could be kept in a barrel all year round. That was always one of the best things about pork was that it cured so well that you would just keep it around. And so as people became more urban, as they had access to butchers and later supermarkets, as they had access to more income, as they could keep fresh meat in their refrigerator, their consumption of beef went up and their consumption of pork declined. In the years starting in the 50s and 60s, there was another trend, which was consumption of chicken rose just dramatically. It was leaving not only pork but also beef in the dust. And the pork industry was really concerned about this, and they wanted a way to combat this trend, which was not good for their industry. And so what they discovered was that they could market certain parts of the pig, particularly the loin and the tenderloin, as a white meat.
Yeah.
This was one of the reasons driving this trend was that there was a new concern that animal fats, cholesterol, were driving heart disease, and that chicken, particularly chicken breast, being so pale and lean, that was a clean and healthy meat, whereas the bloody red meat of beef and pork was unhealthy for you. So they thought, okay, we will turn pork from a red meat into a white meat. And the surprising thing is that they actually did this through a concerted breeding effort. They transformed. It wasn't just a marketing slogan, the other
right.
white meat. They actually did produce a new type of pig.
So it's right around this time that things change for the life of the pig, and I wanted to get into that. Because you say that the before World War II, American pigs really lived pretty much the way they had lived a century before that, which meant what? How had they always lived? Because we're going to talk about the change as we go.
The American pork industry was really the envy of the world starting about 1810, 1820. And what this meant was the Corn Belt. When you grow corn in the Corn Belt, you're not growing sweet corn to eat on the cob.
Yeah.
You're growing animal feed. And what this meant was that the soil was so rich and corn, this new world crop, was so prolific. You produce so many calories per acre with corn, so much more than you do with wheat, that you created these enormous hog crops. And that's why Americans ate more pork than beef for so much of our history, because we had so much pork. It was so cheap. It preserved so well. And the way almost all pigs were raised, starting in 1800 all the way up through the 1940s and 50s, was on pasture. We talk about pastured pigs now as being something desirable and unusual, but that was just pigs for most of our history. So they would live on pasture all year round. They would get fattened on corn in the fall, and then they would go to slaughter. So living outdoors, sometimes in barns in the coldest areas, but usually just on pasture and maybe in these little shelters during the coldest years, but mostly they lived entirely outdoor lives.
Yeah. And then in the 50s and 60s, you say American farmers started raising hogs like chickens. And this is where the story gets really sad. This is where the slatted floors come into practice, which of course makes the life of a farmer easier. But what about a pig? I mean, talk about this moment, because this is when breeding becomes tightly controlled and feed becomes really scientifically controlled.
Yeah, I mean, I think where we've ended up now is unconscionable, but it's important to look back to the history. This is no vast conspiracy. This is a collection of small decisions that each made sense at the time that add up to something rather unpleasant. So after World War II, there's fewer farm laborers, and when you have fewer laborers, you substitute automation. Land is more expensive. You can make a lot of money growing corn and soy on your land rather than letting pigs run around it. So it makes sense to concentrate pigs into barns. And as you mentioned, one of the things that makes this process possible is the slatted floor. It's so simple. Basically, usually it's a concrete floor with slats cut in it. And what that meant was the pig waste would fall below, be trampled below. It could be flushed out with water, which meant that the most disagreeable task of hog farming, and I've done it, I agree it is unpleasant, scraping manure out of stalls, you didn't need to do that anymore. And that combined with automated systems for feeding and ventilation, combined with the subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics, mm-hmm. which made pigs grow quickly and also helped ward off disease, it meant where we are today, where you have nearly all pigs living in these low metal buildings, in the dark for most of their lives, never walking on dirt or straw, standing on hard floors all their lives, and particularly sows, which are confined to what the industry calls gestation crates,
yeah.
These tiny crates where they spend nearly all their lives. The animal scientist Temple Grandin has called it living your whole life in an airline seat.
There's this story you tell from this confinement facility. This was in 1990, and the observations of a veterinarian. Would you tell that story? Because it really gets to the point of the life of a pig today, what a life of a pig is like. And because you say they endure really, this is how you put it in the book, a litany of horrors.
Well, in this story, this was a veterinarian who had called on one of these facilities that just row upon row of sows that are pregnant. And he noticed, I think there was a outbreak of some sort of illness that he was called in to treat, but he noticed that one particular sow had a broken leg. And he offered to splint that leg for free. And he was refused because this operation was running on such a tight, so few workers that they did not have time to care for a sow with a leg splint. And so it was explained to him that they would just let the sow farrow, have her babies, and then they would shoot her, and her piglets would be fostered off to other sows. But meanwhile, for the 2 weeks until she farrowed, she would be living in agony with a broken leg. And for this veterinarian, that was the final straw, because he had grown up on a pig farm, and that's not something you do when you talk about husbandry as an ancient compact in which, yes, we do kill these animals, but we also treat them well while they're still alive. He thought that in this new situation, the bottom line was everything, and there was no room for making decisions that would be merciful to animals if it would affect the bottom line in every way. So that's for him, that was when he decided that he couldn't support this system anymore.
We got an email from someone who used to work at a pig farm here in Utah, huge pig farm, as this person describes it. He mentions working there for only a week, absolutely horrified as the farm did something they called knocking, which he says, basically, if a piglet wasn't gaining weight quickly enough, our job was to grab the piglet by the hind legs and slam their heads on the concrete floor.
I've heard that described as thumping in other areas. And there was a video that an animal rights group put out, and the industry actually defended it as a as a humane practice of euthanizing these piglets, even though they would show videos of like a cart filled with dead and dying piglets. It was a horrendous video.
You also write about how developmental, you know, hogs develop these behavioral problems, and the industry calls them vices, and they have to deal with them. Would you talk about this? Is not pleasant, but would you talk about that part of the story?
Well, we talked earlier about how smart and curious pigs are. When you put them in facilities like this, they have no outlets for their curiosities. The pigs that become meat are slaughtered at about 6 months of age. So when they're alive, they are very much like puppies. They're playful. They want to explore their world. And when you're standing on hard floors with metal bars around you, you have this miraculous snout that's capable of rooting and doing so much and exploring the world. And yet there's nothing soft. And so they tend to nibble on each other, to bite each other's tails. So that's one vice. Sows that are confined to gestation crates will chew on bars or chains and often bloody their mouths because they're so – well, we assume because they are so bored. They rock their heads back and forth. One person describes it as like being in an insane asylum, just swinging their heads back and forth endlessly.
Early in the book, you mention that even though throughout history people have acknowledged the intelligence of these creatures, that generally has failed to alter its fate. You mention Arnold in the TV show Green Acres. He ends up as pork chops in his trainer's freezer. So we can acknowledge that they're clever and that they're smart, but that doesn't really change their essential purpose for human beings. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. One of our callers, Michael from Kanab, is sort of pointing out this sort of elementary contradiction, as he puts it. You know, we're squeamish about the fact that pigs eat gross stuff, including humans, but we're more than happy to eat them these days. We love bacon. We love all this kind of stuff. What are you doing with that question? Because I'm sure you're getting, and you write about it, of course, in the book.
What I do with the, I mean, you could respond to this question in a number of ways. Some people become vegetarians or vegans. The way I have altered my behavior is I no longer will eat any meat unless I know where it came from, unless I know that it lived a good life before it met its end. That's where I've ended up. I happen to live in a place where there are a lot of local farms where I can go and visit them and see how the pigs lived. But it is a fundamental contradiction because yeah. We do care about animals and yet we also very much like to eat animals. I'm not much in favor of biological explanations of human behaviors, but the hunger for meat runs deep and we will rationalize our way to a steak on the plate however we can.
Yeah.
So sometimes I try to mitigate the suffering of the animals when I'm eating meat. But we have a culture that's set up to hide the practices of modern agriculture from us because certainly the more I knew, the less I wanted to eat the standard meat you find in your supermarket.
You also tell, though, a more kind of optimistic view of farmers who are trying to change the conditions of pigs in modern agribusiness. And you tell this story of a man named Bernard Rolling. He's an ethicist at Colorado State University. And tell the story, if you would. He gives this speech to a group of pork producers. And this was in Ontario, Canada.
Yeah, he's an ethicist, and he has advocated very strongly for a reform of agriculture. And he was very nervous because he'd never given a speech directly to hog farmers. And he thought – really, he thought hog farmers were the most far gone because their industry had been so thoroughly industrialized that he thought that this knowledge had been lost. But he talked to them, and he described what he thought were some of the worst practices. And he was expecting to get shouted down. But then he said one farmer stood up and said, you know, I've been hiding from this knowledge for too long. And he promised to tear down his hog barn. And a couple years later, he did. He created a new system of hog farming in which the sows lived in group housing. And so it's one part of a larger movement in which people are becoming more concerned about the food they eat. You can see it in restaurant chains like Chipotle, which make a point of buying only from certain sorts of producers. You can see it in the activism of groups like the Humane Society of the United States, which is pressuring big buyers like McDonald's to buy only pork that doesn't use certain practices. You can also see it in what are called third-party certifications, groups like Animal Welfare Approved, in which farmers can sign up and the inspectors go out and say, okay, you meet our standards for high animal welfare. So there's a number of movements. There's a substantial movement towards more humanely raised meat. And I think that's very positive. It's a good thing. The only caution I would throw out there, it is still a minuscule portion of the amount of meat that's produced in America.
So does that give you a sense, though, that there's this movement, it's small right now. Can you imagine the lives of pigs in these horrible conditions getting any better in the near future? Economic things would have to be transformed. I mean, how do you feel about that? Do you feel optimistic at all?
I'm optimistic that things are changing. All of the largest pork producers have agreed to phase out gestation crates and to move into group housing. It happens very slowly because farmers have an awful lot of money invested in the current system and it's expensive to change. So that is on the way out. But in the meantime, a lot of pigs are going to continue to live rather unpleasant lives. I would think that probably the next step is to try to provide some mud or some straw for pigs to stand on rather than on the hard slatted floors. So I think there are incremental changes being made. I understand why it's slow. Because there are powerful economic forces at play, I nonetheless think it should be a little faster. And I think that consumers can play a role in making it faster by demanding meat that's raised in more humane ways.
Mark Essig, his book is Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig, joined us from a studio in St. Louis, Missouri. Mark Essig, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.